at 10 of 12, which meant had to bring back counsel from this morning, and so we now proceed to 00-0361, Schultz versus Natwick. Attorney Terry L. Wade, Robbins Kaplan et al., representing the Schultz counsel.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Terry Wade. I represent Barbara Schultz, the estate of Lindsay Schultz, Roger Schultz, Mitchell Schultz, and Russell Schultz, the petitioners in this case. Lawyers are taught to develop a theme of their case. The theme isn't developed by me in this case. It's developed by Justice Babich in Martin and in Neiman. The theme is fundamental fairness. It is an easy one to follow in this case. This court articulated the test to be applied to retroactive changes in damage caps in Martin. The court directs a weighing of the public interest served by retroactive application against the private interests overturned, if any. The court explicitly states that implicit within this analysis is a consideration of unfairness created by retroactive legislation and assumes in the body of the decision that there is unfairness in retroactive application, as there often, but not always, is. The fundamental aspect of this balancing test is indeed fairness. Neiman reaffirms Martin and directs the lower courts to not focus solely on the accrual of substantive or vested rights, or as opposing counsel's brief would suggest, detriment, but to engage in a weighing of the relevant public and private interests grounded in fundamental fairness analysis. The trial court in this case did exactly that. While Neiman had not yet been decided, Martin had been. And the trial court weighed the public and private interests and balanced them and utilized, I respectfully submit, Your Honor, exactly the fundamental fairness and balancing test analysis that this court directed in Martin and reaffirmed in Neiman.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the holding and the conclusion of Martin? Do you think that case came out right?
I do, Your Honor.
Then how do you reconcile that position with your position in this case? Because it seemed, in Martin, you know, we said the rights existed within Martin at the time of the accident, and to take it away retroactively was fundamentally unfair. Now, in this case, as well as in Neiman, it was not the plaintiff that was asking for protection, it was the defendant that was asking for protection. The defendant was saying, hey, I want to be, I'm entitled to the legal position as it existed at the time the accident occurred. That was Martin's argument as well. Now, how do you reconcile Martin with this case? Or with Neiman, for that matter?
Your Honor, in both of those cases, it's presumptuous of me to tell Your Honor what you meant by the decision. But
as the Chief Justice Heffernan used to say, at the time I wrote it, only God and I knew, and now only God knows.
Your Honor, in both opinions, you identified a point at which certain rights vest or are substantive, and are identified. And the opinion was quite clear in saying that's not the end of the analysis. That's actually the beginning of an analysis. There is a taking. And now the question is that untaking unfair in the context of this case, of the facts in this case? And in Martin, it would not have been fair. There were no countervailing facts. There was no balance to countervail the taking. I surmise some debate with regard to the facts underlying Neiman between Justice Bradley and Your Honor. In this case, there is no debate about those underlying facts. In Neiman, the question, the assumption, the hypothetical of the court was that the defendants, in that case, did not have an opportunity to plan their affairs based upon this retroactive change, and that would be unfair. And there was no strong, there was a weak, Your Honor, particularly, there was no strong countervailing balance. In this case, it's the other way around. There is a relatively strong public policy interest, and there is no countervailing balance on the defense side. In this case, it is fair, and that's the distinction. It's fair for, I respectfully submit, Your Honor, four concrete reasons. First, Dr. Natwick and his clinic did not need to rely on the $150,000 damage cap to avoid any possible economic harm. They have no possible economic harm given the regulatory compensatory scheme that's developed by the legislature in medical negligence cases. Dr. Natwick not only admits, as does his clinic, that he has no economic harm whatsoever based on the outcome of this case, whether there's retroactive application of the increase in the damage cap or not. Pick Wisconsin, when it sold this policy to Dr. Natwick, the policy that is in play in this case, did so at a time when there was no cap on damages. Unlimited recovery was available under Wisconsin law. At the time, Pick set its premiums, charged those premiums to Dr. Natwick, and Dr. Natwick and his clinic paid them. So they cannot claim any economic harm. I want to distinguish that from detriment. They're going to pay more if the court applies this retroactively. But it's not unfair for them to do so because they have been compensated for doing so. They've been paid for doing so. Three, I'm sorry, I'm on four.
It's two and three again, then.
Sure. Well, the first I have. Sorry.
I have a long one.
It is a long one, Your Honor. And they're both Dr. Natwick. One is he did not suffer economic harm. And the second is he could not suffer economic harm. The third is Pick suffered no unfair economic detriment. They've been paid to do exactly what this retroactive legislation would have them do. And four, the state fund sets its premiums retroactively. So from the fund's perspective, this is in fact prospective effect, even though it is a retroactive application, because they don't set their rates until after they paid the money. It's now almost 7 years since Lindsay died. It's almost 4 years since this law was changed, and nobody's paid any money on the basis of retroactive application. They've had ample time to plan their affairs prospectively. So there's some interesting language in the Martin decision that talks about, is this really prospective or retroactive? Indeed, the argument can be made, Your Honor, that in this case, while it is retroactive legislation, it really has prospective effect with regard to the defendants in this case.
If I could jump in here now for a moment, this whole itemization, whether it's a log one or whether it's four separate items, presupposes that we apply the balancing test in Martin case by case to the specific facts in each individual case, rather than Lehman standing for the proposition that retroactivity is unconstitutional as a general matter.
Yes.
And that's what the import of this case is, I think. So if you would address yourself to that.
Yes, Your Honor. Justice Sykes, in Martin, this court held that the retroactive change in damage caps was unconstitutional. What the court didn't say in Neiman, we don't have to decide this again. We already decided that in Martin. It depends on the level of generality at which one addresses the issue. In Neiman, this court addressed that issue with regard to some assumed facts and indeed an analysis of the real-world practical effect on insurance companies was part of the analysis in Neiman. And those facts aren't here in this case. From law school on, we're all taught that some cases are controlling and others are distinguishable. And on the facts of our case, Your Honor, I submit that this is a distinguishable situation. We have different facts. The facts assumed and discussed by Justice Babbage in Neiman were that the insurance company, and even more importantly, the insured, did not have an opportunity to conduct their affairs in anticipation of the change in caps to protect themselves from future burdens, economic burdens. Those underpinnings of Neiman are not here in this case. Even before Neiman was decided, if one looks at the decisions of this court with regard to retroactive application of changes in damages available, fundamental fairness is throughout all of them. And the question always is, why is it fair to do this retroactively? And in most cases, on most facts, it's not. And it's not on the facts in Martin. And Your Honor asked if I agreed with Martin, and I do agree with the outcome in Martin. Any other decision outcome would be unfair. And I think the analysis is accurate.
I want to ask you if you agreed with Neiman.
I agree with Neiman. For the same reason, because the facts assume do not give parties a fair opportunity to plan their affairs in a prospective way. Not so in this case. In this case, the parties planned their affairs in a way that would where the retroactive application of damage cap has absolutely no economic effect on them whatsoever.
Could I ask you, sir, the Lindsay tragic incident occurred on December 1st, 1995.
Yes, sir.
Suppose it had occurred on December 1st, 1997. Would that case be distinguishable from this case in your analysis?
It may be, Your Honor. It may be factually distinguishable. I don't know what the rate-setting policies of PIC would have been in 1997. And so I would have to do that discovery and to obtain that information. But it's certainly possible that that I would have not have one leg of the argument that I'm relying upon in this case.
Well, if the rate-setting policies had been different, would the impact on the family have been any different?
The impact on the family would not be any different, and indeed the rate setting would not change the impact on Dr. Natwick or his clinic either. Under the system that's set up for medical malpractice claims, Dr. Natwick would not have any personal exposure, whether the policy was sold in 94, 95, 96, or 97. He is protected. The legislature has determined that medical negligence matters, healthcare professionals get some special protection that other tortfeasors don't get. And that special protection is a distinguishing feature between the defendants in Neiman and the defendants in a medical negligence case. Justice Babbage and the majority in Neiman was clear to articulate the concern about the impact of the retroactive change in damage cap on the individual defendant, as distinguished from the insurance carriers involved, was a very important and critical component of the analysis.
As I hear you, what you seem to, if I can sum up, you seem to be saying that, at least in Neiman and certainly in Martin, there were people that relied on the settled law, or on the law, and therefore they deserve protection.
It would be unfair not to protect them.
Right. But in this case, you seem to be saying that nobody relied on the law. Is that an accurate summation? Was there anybody that relied on the settled state of the law in this case?
I don't believe.
To their detriment?
I don't believe there was, Your Honor, to their detriment. And in that sense, it is prospective in effect, though retroactive in reality. Nobody relied.
Nobody relied on the fact that they would have more limited liability. They didn't make economic plans on that basis, that they'd only be liable for X amount instead of X plus. Doesn't sound logical.
Because of the way it worked, they didn't, Your Honor. The record is quite clear. When PICC sold the policy, there was no cap on damage limitations, and the policy is a one-year period. And so when they sold the policy, set the rates, and charged Dr. Natwick, they did so at a time when there was no cap. None at all. About 5 months later, a cap was imposed of $150,000 on the component of damages that we're here about. But PICC continued to charge, didn't send Dr. Natwick back any of his premium. They kept the money, and so in effect, PICC had a windfall. Fast forward 2 years, and the legislature... And I want to say this, Barbara Schultz, her family, and other aggrieved parents and families petitioned for redress of grievances, for a rebalancing of the scales of justice that they said they submitted to the legislature and the executive branch of government were inappropriately, unconscionably misaligned. And the legislature and the executive branch accepted those petitioners' argument and said the value of Wisconsin children has been understated. Not only prospectively, but it's a mistake we've made and we want to correct it retrospectively. And they raised the cap from 150 to 500,000. So now the windfall that PICC got from unlimited to 150 is now only a windfall of unlimited to 500,000. They still get a windfall. Because when they sold the policy and collected the premiums, they did so on the basis of no cap whatsoever. And they still have the cap of 500,000.
And did they change the policies? Put on caps after the legislative cap went into effect?
I cannot honestly answer that question, Your Honor. I don't think I have the discovery and the information in the record to address that issue.
And you don't know whether there was a change in determination of their loss ratio on the basis of the cap going down. I mean, your client's not the only client involved with, and NatWick is not the only insured. You've got a lot of people after that that come on board.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your...
What I'm trying to say is that maybe as to your client, there's been no detriment. But you got other people who bought policies after the cap went on, and then after the cap was released, and then you put them all in the mix, you're going to have different results for all of them?
I suppose that's theoretically possible, though I would suggest, Your Honor, that there aren't any of those cases left in the system, that this is it. And,
yeah, but we're going to have another case that's going to involve another statute where you're going to have caps or something else that's retroactive. And we have to apply the rule of law, theoretically, that's evolving. And the question then is, as a result of what you want a trial court to apply in every case we have retroactive legislation. What are the benefits and detriments in that particular case?
I believe that's exactly what this court has said should be done and did, in fact, in Martin, and again in Neiman on different facts.
And a different statute.
I'm sorry?
And a different statute, right?
And a different statute. Both
that,
are different.
Doesn't that make a difference?
Depends on the level of generality at which you approach the problem, doesn't it, Your Honor? If that is a different fact, but so also is the fact that there is no economic detriment to the defendants in this case, and there was economic detriment assumed to the defendants in Neiman. Both of those are different facts. The issue is, are they important different facts or not? I submit, Your Honor, that they are. I understand an argument could be made to the contrary. I might note that the counsel for Dr. NatWick makes the argument that there is ought be no distinction between general wrongful death damage claims and medical negligence wrongful death claims. There is a meaningful and important distinction, and that is the fact that medical negligence defendants are protected from personal exposure under any circumstance. The very concern Justice Babbage and the majority of this court articulated as a basis for the opinion in Neiman. And that is a meaningful distinction. The legislature has formulated a fairly complex system of patient compensation with regard to medical negligence cases that does not exist in other areas of negligence. And I respectfully submit that because of that, the legislature and executive ought be accorded even more deference with regard to that area than this court has said they should have even in other cases. The court has been very clear that deference should be accorded the decisions of the other branches of government. And in this case, those other branches of government have clearly concluded that both with regard to prospective application and retroactive application, the opportunity for families to recover fair compensation needed to be adjusted. Justice Babbage and the majority of this court in Neiman respectfully acknowledged those values. And I submit in this case, those values are relatively strong compared to the countervailing real world economic issues and for which there is no support whatsoever. The public policy interests involved in this case include the opportunity for the citizens of Wisconsin to seek fair compensation for losses and an affirmation of public confidence that laws will be enacted fairly without advantage to the powerful at the expense of the less powerful. In this case, these citizens petitioned the government for redress of grievances, and the government responded and rebalanced those scales. I respectfully submit they did so in the application of those rebalancing scales in this case complies with fundamental fairness, and the analysis of this court in both Martin and in Neiman. Indeed, I submit that that's exactly what the trial court did in this case. And Justice Abrahamson, your question about what should the courts do in the future, I respectfully submit is exactly what the trial court did in the past in this case. The trial court applied this court's direction exactly and balanced those scales of justice in a fundamental fairness analysis and concluded, yes, there was detriment, but it was fair detriment in this case. The error of the Court of Appeals is that they refused to do that. They simply accepted, they said, this is already a resolved issue. I suppose the Court of Appeals could have done that even in Neiman by looking at Martin and saying retroactive application is not allowed in Wisconsin. But the majority's opinion in both Martin and in Neiman specifically says don't stop with that analysis. And indeed, we overrule language in other cases that suggests that the vested interest analysis is the end of the analysis. That is the beginning of the analysis. The trial court did it in this case. The Court of Appeals didn't. I respectfully submit that on balance, retroactive application in this case is fundamentally fair.
Well, I had problems with Noel. That's the state ex rel Briggs. I think I was the dissent that said Mr. Bright, sir, not dispositive. And then joined the court in Martin and dissented with Justice Bradley in...
Indeed you did.
Pardon me?
Indeed you did, Your Honor.
So my history is one of saying, hey, you got to look at all this very carefully. But I'm a loser in this battle and recognize that. Right. Well, I didn't think justice had been done, and this justice was the loser.
I stand by Judge Justice Babelich's answer, Your Honor.
Well, you should, that's my basic sense of all this, but having only won a partial victory on it, I have a precedent that I worry about, because I believe in that.
And as do we all, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
As do we all. But
when it's favorable.
Right.
but the problem is, I find it very difficult to do the balance on a case-by-case basis. I find it difficult not to do it in categories. Now, Neiman and this case are the same statute, right?
They're not the same statute.
They're not the same
statute. One was raising the cap, one was lowering the cap, or the other way around.
Okay. But you got a cap that's moving. I thought it was the same, but counsel seems to think it's the same. Anyway, I mean, in Neiman and this case, they're not the same, but I thought they were. Anyway, that may be a difference. I read the cases that after the effect, after the accident, there was an increased amount in the court held not to apply. That was an auto accident. They're both forces of society. This is med mal. I don't know if that makes a difference in loss of society. So I just find it very difficult to see the court looking at every single case rather than a group of cases, which seem to pose, to me, looking at it broadly, the same pros and cons, the same balancing. So that's my problem.
My time is up, Your Honor, if I may just have a liberty.
Fast sentence.
Facts vary from case to case.
Absolutely.
And it is the trial court that should follow the dictates of this court and balance in each case. And only if there is a meaningful error ought this court be called upon to readjust that balance. I think the trial court in this case did in fact follow Martin. Did the balancing the court suggested and did it correctly. It's the Court of Appeals that causes us to be here, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Van Sickler, representing Dr. Matlock et al. And you will have 20 minutes. You sharing your time with Mr. Larson of the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. Thank you.
May it please the court, as you know, I'm Mike Van Sicklin from the Madison office of Foley and Lardner. It's my pleasure this afternoon to represent both the two healthcare providers, Dr. Roger Natwick and his employer, the Red Cedar Clinic, and their primary insurance carrier, the Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, which sometimes goes by the acronym of PIC or PICWIS. PIC is a physician-owned insurance company and insures more Wisconsin healthcare providers than any other insurance carrier. As you indicated, I'm going to split my time 2010 with Mr. Larson, who represents the co-defendant, the fund. To the extent you permit me, I'm going to defer questions that deal specifically with the fund, if I can, to Mr. Larson. Obviously, we're here on a sad anniversary and discussing a case which is grounded at bottom in some sad facts. Nevertheless, I think this is a particularly appropriate day to talk about constitutional protections. Those constitutional protections are what distinguish our country and our system. I'm here to answer your questions and to explain why I believe the Schultz Court of Appeals decision, which was unanimous, published, is correct and makes good law. I'm here to explain why my client's due process rights would be violated, where, under these facts, there's settled reasonable expectations about the amount of their liability exposure at the time of the death here were fixed and would be unsettled by retroactivity, why that would be unconstitutional to unsettle those rights, whereas here the plaintiffs have failed to show a substantial public purpose that would warrant making the act retroactive, because that's really the heart of the issue here. I think, notwithstanding all the rhetoric, this is really a very or can be a very simple and direct analysis. It's a two-step analysis. And before I forget, I guess, in my argument, we are talking about the exact same act and statute as we were in Neiman. In Martin, it was different, and this court's most recent decision on retroactive application, Matthews, it was different. But Neiman and this case are on the same statute.
Can I ask you a question before you launch in? Do you know of any other jurisdiction that approaches retroactivity analysis on a case-by-case basis as opposed to deciding in statute by statute?
We did look for that, Your Honor, both originally when we briefed this in the Court of Appeals in here, and then more recently in the last week or so when I tried to update the research, and no, I don't.
Nobody else does it that way.
No.
You take a statute as it stands and decide whether it's retroactive based on a general assessment of the public and private interests that are in play, and then it's done.
And to the best of my knowledge, that's true. And I think one of the reasons I'll kind of jump out of order is in your unanimous decision most recently in Mathis, you looked at this whole question of the plaintiff to overturn these vested interests, the defendants, have to prove, must prove, is your language, that there was a substantial public purpose served. And in Mathis, you said not only was there not a substantial public purpose served by making the act there retroactive, you said, indeed, there are substantial public purposes disserved by making it retroactive. And you focused on individual concerns. And the two that you singled out in Mathis, and that was that paragraph 34 of your unanimous decision, are that it would be unfair to those litigants who had previously tried or settled their cases if suddenly later defendants got a different or better result. And secondly, it would needlessly burden the judicial system and parties to try these issues kind of a case within a case, to transform a simple, straightforward negligence action into some litigation about the underwriting characteristics of the insurer, the loss history of the insured, the premium, you know, structuring, et cetera, which is what Mr. Wade is inviting this court to require here. So, indeed, in Mathis, you said those public purposes would be disserved by retroactivity. Now, I think this two-step analysis is very simple, and that is, it starts with, in Neiman, at paragraphs 13 and 20 of the court's majority decision, you held unequivocally that the retroactive aspect of the 97 Act unsettles what you term to be the substantive or vested private rights of the defendants. All rights, all tortfeasors and their insurers, the right that they have to have their liability exposure fixed as of the date of the injury, that is the date when the claim accrues. You went on to note that under the prior line of cases in this court, arguably that first step would be dispositive here, that merely proving that the tortfeasors here and their insurance carrier had their expectations about the amount of their liability in December of 1995 unsettled. If we'd just proven that alone, that would have been dispositive. But in Neiman, you went and said, no, we're going to overrule that line of cases to the extent that it would suggest that that factor alone is dispositive. But it then shifts, I submit, onto the plaintiff the burden to go forward and show that they have a substantial public purpose that would support making the act retroactive. And that's where they fail. That's the second step. In Neiman, this court held no. Plaintiffs, they had to overcome this vesting of the defendant's rights. And to do so, the plaintiffs had to prove that the public purpose served by making the act retroactive was both substantial and directed at the purpose of retroactivity as opposed to prospectiveness. At paragraph 23 of your decision in Neiman, you held that to outweigh the vested private interest which you held that all tortfeasors and insurers have, quote, "The public purpose supporting retroactivity must be substantial, valid, and intended to remedy a general economic or social issue," end of quote. That's paragraph 23. The must be substantial requirement is imposed by this court in the whole trilogy of cases here, Martin, Niemann, and most recently Mathis. I submit that whereas here the plaintiffs have failed to show a substantial public purpose supporting retroactivity, that's the end. That's dispositive. The Schultzes do not challenge, nor could they, that this court addressed every possible argument that would suggest that there's a public purpose supporting retroactivity, and this court found, it ruled against those purposes. This court found that they were weak. This court found that the type of purposes that are being advanced as being public purposes supported only making the statute prospective, not retroactive.
Well, arguably, counsel, there's a public purpose in making plaintiffs whole. And if there's no countervailing factors to consider, that could take on greater importance in an analysis. Now, here your opposing counsel says there are no countervailing factors. Unlike in Niemann, in which there was reliance by the insurance company, by the insureds, et cetera, and it would be economic detriment to them. Here, there are none. He says there's no reliance. How do you respond to that?
Okay, and that's an excellent question, and really, if I could give you sort of a long answer, because I think it's an important question, is first off, I don't think there are any public purposes served at all by retroactivity. It's only a private purpose. The private purpose of making the Schultzes whole, if you will. Now, as parents, we can understand and our heart goes out to that argument, but as lawyers and judges, I submit that the proper focus is on the public aspect of the purpose, and there are none here.
Counsel, just may I interrupt on that? I believe that we have cases that can be cited for the proposition that there is a public policy in making and compensating injured victims, making them whole. You disagree with that?
Well, there certainly are cases, and I'm aware of the debate in this court in Niemann between the majority and the dissent. You articulated those reasons.
The whole law of torts is to compensate people for wrongs, to fairly compensate.
And the question is the legislature, I mean, the Niemann majority addressed this very argument and said the legislature said that they were fully and fairly compensated as of the time the law was in place.
I'm not really pushing you a lot on this because I'm not sure it's going to get anywhere, but other than I think that there is plenty of law that we can cite that a public policy, and as the Chief says, the basis of tort jurisprudence, or a basis of tort jurisprudence, is to see that the two parties are compensated. Now, there might be lots of countervailing stuff here, but you won't give me that.
Well, I think it's a matter of philosophy. The majority in Niemann disagreed with that argument and said, we've looked at each of these arguments in support of public policy and we don't find them. Now, I understand that you and Justice Abrahamson felt differently, but I think we're bound by the holding in Niemann in that regard. And maybe to get back to the earlier question is, I think that this whole issue of other harm misplaces what's appropriate here to focus on. It misreads this court's holding in Niemann at paragraph 9. There you say that the test is to determine whether a retroactive statute is supported by a rational basis. The public interest served by the statute is weighed against the private interest that it overturns, including any unfairness caused by the retroactivity. And I think that's important, because what this court did in Nyman and says, retroactivity unsettles the vested right in knowing the amount of your exposure as of the time of injury. You don't need to go on and prove some additional greater unfairness, which is what the Schultzes are arguing that we should have to prove. As of the date of the injury here, we had a reasonable expectation we'd only have to pay $150,000. By making it retroactive, the defendants collectively have to pay more than three times that amount. PICC is the largest health care insurer in the state for medical malpractice cases, has had many cases, as reflected in the record, that would be affected. We had harm in the sense of having to pay out more money than we had expected to pay.
Well, now, that's what paragraph 20 of Nyman says. ANPAC's exposure to liability for damages accrued at the same maximum level. These accrued rights are unsettled by the retroactive aspect of 895.04. Is that your argument?
Yes. That, having proven that, that what they're asking you to do is focus on a different time period to show harm. We're saying that as of the date of the injury in December of 95, we had settled expectations that our exposure was $150,000. What the Schultzes are arguing is that let's go back and look at PICC's underwriting history when they set out this policy and decided what premiums to charge. Let's look at the claims file for these insureds and decide whether the premium should be changed and so forth. Those are all different and earlier time periods. And again, that's sort of Justice Prosser's question, is that I submit that those are incorrect time periods to focus on, because it leads you down this path of having plaintiffs who had the same injury, the families suffering the same grief, ending up with much different recoveries based solely on the idiosyncrasies of whether their insurers followed certain underwriting practices, and it requires courts and parties to wrestle with all these collateral issues that I don't think are appropriate here. The third thing I think that that argument ignores is that this court's holding in Nyman. This is exactly the difference between the way the majority addressed the issue in Nyman and the way the dissent wanted to frame it. In Nyman, the majority did not focus on the individual particularities of the ANPAC insurance policy or its premium structure or its underwriting history. Instead, it said basically, we have this unsettled effect from retroactivity on the vested right. That's all we really need to focus on as far as the defendants. We then go to look at the plaintiff's side for the public interest. Now, the dissent at paragraphs 42 and 43 in Nyman advanced the same almost identical argument that the Schultzes do here. They wanted the majority to focus on the particularities of the individual insurance contract there and talk about the unfairness. And this court chose not to go down that path. And I submit that since public purposes do not vary on a case-to-case basis or by a party-to-party basis, that the holding in Nyman is dispositive, and that unless this court wants to overturn Nyman, and I think in part both Martin and Matthews, we are bound here, because in all three of those courts you held that the plaintiffs, in order to overturn that settled expectation of the defendants, plaintiffs had to prove a substantial public purpose. And you have found in Nyman that it is not here. Now, Justice Bradley, I understand you think there are purposes, but you expressly found that they were not substantial in Nyman, and I think that is controlling precedent. Now, with a little time left to me,
In the dissent in Nyman, the dissenter said, well, you've got a maximum coverage in your policy, whether it was 250 or 300 or 400, it's not broken down by loss of companionship. So your ultimate liability of the insurance company is the same with or without loss of companionship. Is that true here too?
In this case, the record does not reflect exactly what all the underwriting factors are. The affidavit.
I'm not talking about any underwriting factor. I'm talking about the face of the policy. Is there a maximum limit on liability?
There's a $400,000 limit on liability, and it covers any damages arising from the medical procedure, including but not limited to the non-economic damages covered by the statute here. But I guess I was trying to answer that the underwriting considerations would not focus solely on these types of damages, but rather all these other considerations, which again is, I think, the path this court should not go down. Now,
Mr. Sicklin, I'm not sure that I received an answer that I'm satisfied with respect to the reliance question. So maybe if you could broaden that up, fill in a few little skin on the flesh, or put some flesh on the bones. The problem that I have is that in Nyman, there's no question that, you know, that the insurance company set its rates, that people insured themselves based upon what they thought was the law at the time, et cetera. So there was an awful lot of reliance on the law, at least. That's how I looked at it. That's how the majority looked at it in Nyman. But there were people who relied on this and set their economic affairs based upon it, at least theoretically. Yet here, what Mr. Wade is arguing somewhat persuasively is that nobody relied. Nobody set their nobody's economic expectations were upset in the sense that they had to reorder their lives or reorder their economic priorities or spend money where they hadn't spent it before. There's no economic detriment. Sure, as you said, there's an expectation. You know, on the day that it occurred, well, if we have to pay, we're going to have to pay $150,000 and not $500,000. But, I mean, that's just an expectation, but nothing. That they didn't order their lives based upon that expectation. So, you know, what reliance? Can you give me any more flesh than what you gave me? As what I heard was simply an expectation.
Well, let me try to flesh it out as best I can. I think it's important when you look at Nyman to differentiate between the plaintiff, the underinsured driver, and their expectations and reliance. Because arguably they would have gone out and purchased more insurance coverage had they thought they could collect $500,000 instead of $150,000. Okay, but that's a different reliance issue than the ANPAC defendant insurer. There was no analysis in the majority decision that looked at whether ANPAC, if it had been clairvoyant and had seen that their exposure might retroactively have been increased, that they would have or not have increased or changed their premium structure. That's not in the record as best I know, and it's certainly not in your majority decision. Here, it's the same argument. We don't really know. It's speculation. Would PIC have acted differently when they set their budgets, when they made distribution decisions on dividends, when they decided on capital expenses in 1997 and 98? Had they realized that they would suddenly be exposed to paying not $150,000 per wrongful death case, but $500,000 for minors or $350,000 for adults? The record does not explore what PIC might have done had they been clairvoyant enough to do it. But certainly, they are exposed to paying up, you know, 2.5 to 3 times more than they had expected on the date of those injuries between May 95, when the law went into effect, saying it's... this act took effect in April of 98.
Oh, they may have set aside more reserves, but...
Now, your question is, well, you set the underwriting considerations back in 94 before you sold Dr. Natwick's policy in January 95. Would you have acted differently had you seen this coming? Then we have to deal with cost of living adjustments and the rate at which claims were coming in and jury verdicts were being awarded. I think oversimplifies it to say, well, the amount of the coverage, you know, went from being unlimited to $500,000, so Pick got the windfall, as Mr. Schultz, or the Schultz family lawyer says.
Well, as I hear your argument then, you seem to be saying that in all cases involving retroactivity, there's going to be some reliance, there's going to be people that rely on the settled law, and therefore, Nyman, although it may purport to be an on-its-face challenge, is as applied challenge, is really an on-its-face decision. Because, like we said in paragraph 7, when considering the constitutionality of paragraph 14, considering the constitutionality of expressly retroactive laws, the Martin test is applied. And then we go on in paragraph 15 to set forth that test. We must balance the public interest. So we seem to be saying in paragraph 15 that every case involving retroactivity, we have to balance the interests. And you seem to be saying, right, but every time you do that, we win.
No, I think there's two parts of the balance. I think that the burden essentially shifts once you prove a vested right that's being unsettled by retroactivity. I think the plaintiff then, or the party supporting retroactivity, has to show a substantial public purpose. All three of your decisions emphasize must show that. Now, if they do show that, I submit, then we get to this other question of, do we then have to come back and show the magnitude of the harm above and beyond, or the level of unfairness above and beyond just the vested impact? Yes. But I don't think we get there here, because under Nyman, you found that there was no substantial public purpose. I admit, had you found and agreed with the dissent in Nyman that there are substantial public purposes served by making it retroactive, we would have to show something more than our vested rights being affected. We would have to go back and show that we had to pay out of pocket, that our budgeting would have been different, and the like. But that's not the issue here before this court. And I think it's important when you look at your most recent decision, Mathis, to see the direction this court is going. There, it's a unanimous decision, and you emphasize the must language, and you concluded with a very broad condemnation of making these acts retroactive. And at paragraph 42 of Mathis, and I'll wind up here.
Before you wind up, counsel, yeah. I just want to get back to this public purpose, just because you had the Nyman opinion in front of you before Justice Babish told you to take a look at paragraph 14. Take a look at paragraph 25, and let me then re-ask the question that I asked earlier, whether it's from the dissent point of view or from the majority point of view. Isn't it correct that in Wisconsin law there is a public purpose that underlies tort law to provide full compensation to those who are injured by the negligent conduct of another?
I think there's a public policy served by those things, but not making it retroactive. That's
not
the issue.
My question, because before when we were talking about this or discussing this, I thought that you indicated that the dissent said there was a public purpose, but the majority did not and could not find that it underlies tort law, and the chief kind of emphasized that. My only point is, the majority of paragraph 25, I think, also acknowledges that, unless I'm reading paragraph 25 incorrectly.
Maybe I misunderstood the question. I certainly acknowledge that there are beneficial public purposes one could articulate in support of changing the wrongful death caps prospectively. And the question...
So my question dealt with whether or not there's a public policy in Wisconsin to provide full compensation to those who are injured by the negligent conduct of another. I mean, I think that's a public policy.
That's,
it can be outbalanced by lots of other things, but it is a public policy.
Okay, maybe we're talking past each other. I agree that's a public policy, as you state there. I just don't think it's advanced by retroactivity. So I am out of time, so I will stop.
Thank you,
thank
Mr.
you very
Van
much.
Sicklin. Mr. Larson, representing Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund.
Good afternoon. Pleases the court, I'm Mark Larson. I represent the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, and I'm going to primarily address the issues raised by the petitioners with regard to the fund. The first thing I want to address is not an issue that was raised in the oral argument here today, but certainly was raised in the brief by the petitioner, and that is whether the fund can be liable for an amount different than the other parties to this case, namely Dr. Nadwick. And clearly, Wisconsin law is the fund is an indemnitor of Dr. Nadwick. There is no provision whatsoever that the fund can somehow be independently liable for an amount greater than what Dr. Nadwick is. This court in the Tamminen case, in construing Chapter 655.27 sub 1, which is the paragraph that really creates the fund, described the fund as an excess insurer. And in further describing it, they said that, this court said that its liability as an excess insurer is derivative and depends on the liability of the insured. So if Dr. Nadwick, his liability is limited because of the constitutional issues in this matter to $175,455.18, the fund cannot be liable for an amount starting above $400,000 because there's no liability on the insured health care provider's part. This court similarly addressed that issue in Fund versus Lutheran Hospital, in which it indicates that the fund's liability is not triggered until the underlying primary limits are exhausted. And that was in following another Supreme Court decision in the Fund versus St. Paul. So if the act in this case would be unconstitutional as applied to Dr. Nadwick, then there cannot be, by operation of the statutes and the case law, any liability over and above that on the part of the fund. And I think you can somewhat analogize this to statute of limitations issues. The fund cannot be sued after the expiration of the statute of limitations if the statute has expired with regard to the health care provider. And it's the same type of thing where substantive rights are created on the date that the statute of limitations expires, and the fund has the benefit of those rights through its derivative liability for the health care provider. There's nothing within this Act, Act 89, that changes the fund's liability in this situation. The second thing I want to address, in part because a statement was made that the fund sets its assessments retroactively. That is not correct. Statute, I think, clearly indicates they do it on an annual basis, and those premiums are paid over an annual basis. They do take into account past experiences, and that's one thing that happens. Now, there's no way of going back and going and reassessing people in the past. What we would be looking at is the fund recouping money based on future to future health care providers and current health care providers. Another point about the fund that's important is that the fund is entirely funded by monies paid by private, non-governmental health care providers, and that includes administrative expenses. So any insinuation to the contrary that the state somehow picks up the tab for some aspect of the fund, that is simply not true, and I've cited the statutes, which are somewhat complicated in reading how they all interact between the three of them, but all of the monies that constitutes the fund and any expenses related to it are paid for by the private non-governmental health care providers. Now that money is held in a fund, and of course it's invested. And that's one of the things that actually plays into this whole issue, and if I get a chance to talk about that, I will get to that in a moment. I wanted to express why I think a case-by-case analysis as proposed by petitioners in this case would be very problematic. And one thing that struck me is you could have literally the same act on the same day by the same person causing the same injuries, and the constitutionality of retroactively increasing that person's liability or the liability that would be borne by his or her insurers would be dependent on an analysis of the financial health of that person or those insurance companies. And so that begs a number of questions. Unfortunately, with the climate of things, I have a couple of medical malpractice insurance companies who are in financial trouble, unlike Pick. They don't have the same, either the same management team or whatever, but they're in financial trouble. So if they are exposed to an additional $350,000 in liability, and that's a substantial effect to that company because they're on the verge of going into liquidation. Arguably, under the plaintiff's analysis or the petitioner's analysis, that would be unconstitutional. But if you have a healthy insurance company, the plaintiff argues, it would be constitutional. I think that's a terribly problematic situation for courts to address, and it's simply...
Well, would you wipe out the balancing test?
Yeah, I'm talking about applying the balancing test. If you're going to have to do that, you're
going to... Wipe it out, because if we apply the balancing test but always come out with the same result, then we're engaged in an exercise in futility.
Well, if this court applies the balancing test, as you did in the Neiman case, and it was quite clear, I thought, and I had understood, I think, a lot of parties and counsel in the state of Wisconsin, that when this court issues a decision on the constitutionality of the statute and severs retroactive from prospective, that that's a statement on, a facial statement on the constitutionality of that provision. What I'm addressing here is really is the petitioner's argument that you should address each and every case that comes up, that it may be a different constitutional result in each and every case. And what I'm trying to point out is you can literally have the same act, and depending on the financial health of either the tortfeasor or his or her insurers, you would arrive at a different conclusion under the petitioner's analysis. And I think that's a very problematic situation that this court does not want to open that Pandora's box to. In fact, if you look at the financial analysis that is presented with regard to the fund was actually in a deficit at the day of this injury. It was in a deficit when this increase was enacted. The material submitted to you, and that's what was in the record because that was what was relevant at the time we were before the trial court several years ago, was that there was a projected black existence for the fund of about $7,000. in part, that has to do with the economic conditions. So that's something that's going to change all the time, which is another question. When do you apply this balancing test to see how much of an impact the financial increased liability of the retroactivity, how much that will hurt the defendant? Well, when do you look at that?
Well, here, you know, the first part of the test is that we consider the private interests that are overturned by retroactivity, and then secondly, we consider the public purpose that is served by retroactivity. And assuming for the moment, notwithstanding the dialogue between Justice Bradley and Mr. Van Sicklen, assume that the public purpose is full compensation for injured victims. And here you have already conceded, I believe, that there has not been full compensation. I mean, isn't there an agreement, maybe it's not this case, but isn't there an agreement that there was $500,000 worth of injuries here and she's only getting $150,000?
I think what was agreed,
didn't you people concede that?
I think what was agreed to, Your Honor, was that factually if this had gone to a jury, that we believed that a jury would award a sum so that the second cap, the increased retroactive cap, would come into play.
So, but isn't that just another way of saying that this victim has not been compensated completely?
Well, not under your definition, Your Honor. I would say in Neiman, you stated quite clearly, and I can't cite to the paragraph, but you stated in the majority opinion that full compensation was not an issue in Neiman because full compensation was defined by what the damage limit was on the day of injury or death. So that's true in Neiman, that's true in our case. I mean, that's the statement of the law, and that's the precedence I'm going on. So you defined full measure of full compensation.
What about Article 1, Section 9? I'm just teasing.
Hasn't
the legislature also been quite arbitrary in saying that full compensation is related to the age of the victim? In other words, if someone dies 2 days before their 18th birthday, it's $500,000. If it's 2 days after their 18th birthday, it's $350,000.
That's very true.
Well, isn't the operative point here, though, not whether or not full compensation for tort victims is or is not an important public policy, but whether it has anything to do with retroactivity, or whether it is served or furthered by retroactivity?
Right, and in your case, you defined and you addressed that issue of whether full compensation, how important of a public policy interest, and I would differ with Mr. Van Sicklen on that. I think you didn't say that it was no factor. You looked at it and you said, well, here's how it's defined, and there is really full compensation because of how you defined that term. And then you went on to characterize the public policy support for retroactive to be very weak. In fact, you went through an analysis and said it's clearly weaker than what was rejected by the Supreme Court in the Knoll case, where the legislature tried to remedy inflationary impact in the workers' compensation setting. So, you know, to that extent, it's not that it wasn't a factor, but that it was a very weak factor. And to just go back to the other part of the balancing test and address what I think is a question from Justice Bablich yet is, the impact is quite clear here. There is a dollar figure that the defendants in this case were exposed to that was retroactively increased. And it was a significant factor. That's a significant number, and if that happened in multiple cases, that was a very clear and significant impact. And my issue
How does that impact? Could you fill that in?
Well, because if the law is not applied retroactively, the wrongful death cap in this case is $150,000.
Right.
If it's applied retroactively, The cap in this case is $500,000. That's an increase in liability of the defendants of $350,000. That's a clear, quantifiable impact on the substantive rights of the defendants in this case.
That's always going to be there, though, right?
Well, but I mean, I think that's what, but that's what you look at. I mean, there are cases where you could look at where maybe the impact is de minimis. It's a very small impact in some way. But this is not a de minimis impact. This is a $350,000 impact. And you haven't gotten into that. But you're looking at, are there rights that are disturbed? Yes, and they're disturbed in which way? They're disturbed in the sense that there is now $350,000, potentially, in greater liability. So that's what is, you know, weighed against the public policy interest, which you have already determined to be weak in the area of supporting retroactive application. Thank you.
Your position is Neiman is okay as a balancing test, but it has to be balanced on the face of it, generally, general groups, but not specific cases as they come up.
Well, I think this court and the way this court functions as the, you know, the law developing court, and I address this, I think, fairly extensively in my brief, is that this court is the one that sets the law. If you want courts to do things on fact by, you know, or case by case basis, you leave it to the trial courts and then the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals analyzed this case, determined that you had made a decision facially on the statute, on the retroactive application of the statute, and they followed that law. If this court is going to say, we didn't mean that,
yep,
you're opening the door up to, then what's the value of getting a decision from this court on constitutional issues like this? Does that mean that back when Martin was decided, the fund could have come in with every Med-Mal case that it had and re-argued what the impact was on the other families? Or did they have to live with the decision in Martin that, and the way it was worded, very similarly to how you worded it in Neiman, that it was broad, it wasn't just Cheryl Martin, it was people in similar situations. And that's what you said here. You talked about tortfeasors in a very similar way. Same with the Matthews case. You know, clearly, everybody in this state is, I think, believing that Matthews said you don't apply the change in joint and several liability retroactively. And I don't think you want people coming back here on a case-by-case basis with that issue. Thank you very much.
Justice Babbage has a question.
I grant you that $500,000 is a lot more than simply peanuts over $150,000. That can be the math, too. That's, you know, $350,000 ain't paid. But in terms of the real impact on an insurance company, the little I understand how insurance companies operate, and I understand a little how they do, when an incident occurs, they set aside reserves to cover their potential exposure. Or at least it's a figure that they put on it, because then in accounting they have to make a future account. So other than, you know, if you, in this instance, you put aside a reserve $150,000. Well, if we make it retroactive, that reserve is actually $500,000. But in reality, you haven't paid out any money anyway. So, you know, is there a greater impact on you or another insurance company other than the amount that you set aside for reserve?
Well, with regard to the fund specifically, which is what I will address, as I said, the fund is created and kept alive, if you will, by assessments paid by the healthcare providers in this state. And it's the private non-governmental healthcare providers, because all governmental healthcare providers are excluded from the fund, participating in the fund. So all the physicians and hospitals in the state have to pay to make up the difference of any additional liability that's imposed. Of course, there's money that's in a fund that gets invested. Now, what you will see, though, also is the statute imposes limits on how much the assessments can be increased in any given year. So you can't go out and recoup all that in one fell swoop. Also, as you would see from the materials that has actually been submitted by the petitioners in support, for a lot of years the fund ran in the red to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, the way that is written. But then when you got to the year 1999, because favorable economic conditions, that had changed. So again, I mean, do we go back to having to look at and show that now the economy has changed, that the impact on the fund is different than it was 2 years ago? I mean, that's a Pandora's box, I believe, if that's what you're going to analyze. I think what you'd look at is what is here, that you've increased by threefold the liability retroactively. And that's a significant disturbance of settled rights. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wade.
I first would like to just cite petitioner's appendix at page 103, which is actually something off the internet from the state fund, and it says annual fund premium rates are set by the Board of Governors with the approval of the state legislature. The fee setting process begins with an actuarial assessment of expected loss exposure based on prior year experience. So the record actually does reflect that it's the prior year experience that is the basis for fee setting by the state fund. I also might note that the state fund is administered, according to the materials in the appendix, by the State Commissioner of Insurance. That's the mailing address. The Commissioner of Insurance staffs it. It's a state agency. I respectfully submit my learned adversaries want to reverse both Martin and Neiman. They don't want to apply a balancing test. They want to go back to the vested interest, substantive right, stop the analysis case law, which this court overruled. Mr. Van Sicklin focuses on the detriment. He says there's detriment. There is detriment. We're not debating that. And he says stop. The majority of this court in Neiman says don't stop. We reverse those cases that say you should stop at that point. Now you do a balancing analysis to determine whether that detriment is unfair. And that's what this case is all about. It's not unfair. It was unfair in Martin. It was arguably unfair in Neiman. It would not be unfair in this case. To the contrary, it would be unfair not to apply the statute retroactively in this case. PIC Wisconsin charged premiums for no cap. No cap. It collected that profit. Dr. Natwick has no exposure whatsoever. The citizens of the state of Wisconsin petitioned their government. And the legislative and executive branches weighed the competing interests brought before them and concluded that an injustice was being done, that the value imputed to the value of the lives of children in Wisconsin was unconscionable, that it was unjust, and that fair compensation was not given to the families, or the opportunity for fair compensation was not given to the families of the state of Wisconsin. And indeed, Governor Thompson, when he signed the legislation, and this is in the appendix, indicated that this new law, the Lindsey-Justin law, as it was called, created the opportunity for families to recover fair compensation. They, the legislature and executive branch, concluded specifically that to correct this injustice of unfair compensation, the opportunity for fair compensation needed to be allowed both prospectively and retrospectively. And while in comparison to strong private interests that may be weak, it is a strong public policy. It is a strong public policy articulated by the executive and legislative branch, and indeed I submit it as a strong public policy recognized throughout the case law of the court of this court. This court has articulated a strong intent to defer to those judgments of the legislature and executive, and has articulated a balancing test to apply to attempt to do so. Application of that balancing test was done by the trial court in this level and resulted in retroactive application of the statute. I respectfully submit the same outcome should occur when this court analyzes the application of that balancing test to the facts of this case.
How do you answer the argument by put forth by Mr. Van Sicklen, I think it was his argument, that said that if you require every case to be balanced, you know, to bring about this, then that's a really tough impact on judicial resources, among other things.
I respectfully disagree. The two people can be injured in a hospital on the same day, the same hospital. And whether one will obtain a recovery or not will depend entirely on the balancing of the relative facts and circumstances of each of those situations. That's what the judiciary is all about. Facts are different in one case for another. In some circumstances there's recovery, and in other circumstances they're not. If we're going to actually use a balancing test and fairly and honestly apply that on the facts of each case, then there will be different outcomes based on the relative merits of the public interest versus the private interest articulated by this court in the circumstances of the case that comes before it. The trial court did exactly that, Your Honor, and found that there is no detriment to the defendants in this case. No unfair detriment, excuse me. That's very important. There is a detriment. It is not an unfair detriment. That's the critically, it's the reliance issue, Your Honor, that you were so clear about in saying defendants such as ANPAC, as well as individuals who have purchased a specific level of insurance, would reasonably rely. There's no reliance in this case. The record is clear. It's unequivocal. When PIC sold the policy, there was no cap. I'm out of time. It's
Thank
my
you.
Great honor to appear.
Is the policy in the record? Okay. Yeah, all right. Thank you. We finish our hearing on all